A cold gust of wind whistles down the chimney in a high-pitched wail that sounds eerily like a banshee screaming. A line from Dante's last letter flashes into my mind.
You are the storm. You're the source of everything that's happening.
Then I recall something Fiona told me the day she came in and set off the alarm.
A spirit is energy manifest in itself, akin to an electrical storm gathering force until it discharges a bolt of lightning. When a spirit is upset, that emotion, that energy is transformed into a physical outcome. Hence your open cupboards and drawers.
And one other thing that I didn't begin to comprehend until just now.
I'd say the spirit who lives in this house is bloody furious.
The way she looked at me when she said that, it was almost as if she were talking about me. Like an army of spiders. Cold horror crawls over my skin. I whisper hoarsely, "No."
Fiona says quietly, "Yes, my dear, I'm afraid so."
With the explosive force of a bomb, 100 different memories detonate in my head all at once. How shocked Fiona was when she saw me the day after Michael's funeral. How she asked in that peculiar tone,
"So, you'll be staying in the house?"
How all the people at the grief group ignored Madison, the woman whose child was abducted years ago. How she sat alone in the circle as if she were invisible to everyone except me. How Eddie, the handyman who dressed like a hippie, didn't have a cell phone and thought David Letterman was only a therapist. How, when I went to find him, that therapist didn't exist. How all the roofers I called never called back. How the security camera only recorded static when I went out into the yard. How Destiny, the psychic, said mournfully,
"I'll pray for you."
How when I rang the bell, her mother opened the door, looked around, then closed it, as if there was no one standing there. The death card, the lovers, the reversed magician indicating I needed to let go of my illusions, the upright ten of swords that hinted at deep wounds, painful endings, betrayal. Fiona saying,
"Reality is simply what we believe it to be. Each of us makes our own truths, even ghosts."
How when Claire first came in tonight, she referred to the spirit she came to contact as her before correcting herself. Shaking so hard I can barely stand, I whisper, "If you give people the light, they'll find their own way." When I meet Fiona's gaze, her eyes are shining with tears. I sob, then slap a hand over my mouth to stifle it. Then I grab the phone from Claire, run back to the junk drawer and pull things out, frantically tossing pens, post-it notes, takeout menus, and batteries onto the floor until I find what I'm looking for. Eddie, the handyman's business card. I didn't notice it before, but the card is fragile and yellowed with age, the ink flicking in places. It looks as if it was printed decades ago, which it probably was. With the sound of the raging storm outside nearly deafening me, I dial his number. The phone rings twice before a man picks up.
"Homefront handyman, three generations strong. How can I help you?"
Gripping the phone in my shaking hands, I ask, "Is Eddie there, please?" His short silence seems surprised.
No. This is Mark. How can I help you?"
"Please, I really, really need to speak with Eddie. Can you put him on the phone? Is he around?"
After another pause, the man on the other end of the line says,
"Is this a joke or something?"
I shout,
"Just put him on the phone!"
He sighs heavily.
"Look, lady, I normally don't pick up this late, but business has been slow, so I did. You've made me regret it. Have yourself a good night."
"Please,"
I beg, desperate.
"I have to talk to Eddie. I have to talk to him right now."
He snaps.
"Yeah, well, that's going to be kind of hard, lady, because my grandpa died in 1974.
All the breath leaves my lungs. A sob catches in my throat. Two more fluorescent light bulbs in the ceiling explode with a pop.
"Kayla."
When I whirl around in panic, Fiona is holding out one of Dante's envelopes to me.
"Read the name on the return address," she says gently.
Hyperventilating, I snatch it from her hand.
"Dante Alighieri,"
I cry, shaking my head.
"His name is Dante Alighieri, so what?"
"Don't just look at it. See."
When I return my gaze to the upper left corner of the envelope, All the letters in the return address are now moving, trading places with one another, and slowly rearranging themselves into something else. I blink rapidly, trying to clear my vision. It doesn't help. The letters move sideways, overlapping, then straightening out into another name. A name that rips a hole straight through the fabric of my heart. Aiden Lee Wright. Dante Alighieri is an anagram for Aiden Lee Wright. Into my mind flashes an image of the framed Thoreau quote on the wall of Destiny's parlor. It's not what you look at. It's what you see. I've been blind, refusing to acknowledge the truth, looking at everything but seeing nothing at all. Tears streaming down my face, I drop the envelope and run from the kitchen. I burst through the door of Michael's office and fall sobbing onto his desk. I snatch up the newspaper with Michael's picture on the front. With shaking hands, I unfold it all the way. When I see the rest of the headline that was obscured, my heart stops beating. The headline isn't "Local Man Drowns," as it appeared when folded. The full headline is "Local Man Drowns Wife." From the other side of the crease, my photo stares back at me. I see myself standing at Michael's grave the day of the funeral, hearing a woman sob my name, and realize with a sensation of the floor disappearing beneath my feet that the name on the headstone wasn't my husband's. It was my own. It all comes back in a rush. A locked iron door inside my mind flings itself open and an icy black ocean of memory floods in. I scream. The windows explode outward into a million razor-sharp glinting shards of glass that are instantly sucked into the storm and carried off into the rainy night. A violent whirlwind rips the newspaper from my hand and sends it flying madly around the room, torn to pieces. Fiona and Claire stand in the office doorway. A small barefoot figure in blue pajamas cowers behind them in terror, peeking out from around Fiona's legs. It's the little blonde boy I kept seeing on the lawn. The boy who took one look at me and screamed in pure terror. The boy who lives here with his parents, Sandy and David Wainwright, who bought this house a month after my husband ended my life. Michael didn't die. Aiden did. Michael killed him right before he killed me.
2. Purgatorio. Even in the grave, all is not lost. Edgar Allan Poe. 37. Fiona.
When I told Kayla that ghosts are simply souls with a story to tell, it was the truth. But the thing about ghosts is that they're unreliable narrators, especially when they're telling a story to themselves.
Figuring out that you're dead is complicated business.
A shout comes from behind me. I turn to find Sandy running down the hall toward us at top speed, her eyes wide and her face white. Clinging to my leg, Bennett bursts into tears when he sees his mother.
She scoops him up into her arms, hugs him tightly against her chest, and stares in horror into the room. Over the roar of the wind, she hollers,
"He snuck out of bed! My God, what's happening?"
"Take him back upstairs,"
shouts Claire. Paper flies past, lifted by the gale, twisting like broken birds in flight. The curtains beside the shattered windows flap and billow. Framed photographs tear themselves from the walls and smash against the floor. Books shoot out of the bookcase as if fired from a gun. A light show erupts from the exploding bulbs in the ceiling and lamps, showering the room in a spray of brilliant white sparks. It's a pageant of sound and fury. The visible chaos when an invisible heart breaks. "I know, poor dear," I murmur, watching the madness. "I'm so sorry." The spot where Kayla stood mere moments ago is now empty. Sandy runs back the way she came, hurrying down the hall with Bennett in her arms. They'll go back to David upstairs and wait for Claire and me to let them know if the spirit of Kayla Reese has finally left their house. They might have to wait a while, however. There's still more of the story left to tell.
38. Aiden. I knew almost from the beginning that Kayla was it for me. Those eyes, you know? So pretty, but so sad. It would take a while to find out what she was so sad about. By then, I'd told her about my father, about how abusive he was, about what I did to protect my mother from his violent rages, about how I'd spent time in prison for it. The judge was lenient because I was underage. My mother's testimony helped too, as did all the other witnesses the defense called to prove we were living in hell with that man. But still, facts are facts. I was a convicted felon. It isn't pretty when you say it out loud. The amazing thing, Kayla never judged me for it. She never looked at me differently. She didn't let it come between us when she had every reason to say peace out and walk away. She'd already been through so much. She didn't need all my shit on top of it. They say her husband was a genius. Brilliant. As if that makes up for anything. Like it's an explanation and an excuse all in one. He was some big shot mathematics professor at the university. Brain like a supercomputer. A supercomputer with a significant glitch. Actually, two. Paranoid schizophrenia being the main one, and a king-size ego being the other. You know what happens when you're sick but too narcissistic to admit it? You don't take your fucking meds, that's what. Yeah, then shit goes sideways. Then you start doing things you might not normally do if you kept your shit under control. Say, for instance, taking a sledgehammer to every television in the house because you're convinced the government is spying on you from behind the screens. Or maybe writing the same quadratic equation over and over in a notebook and telling your wife it's the language of God that the refrigerator magnet that's actually an angel in disguise has been dictating to you. Or possibly standing outside the local grocery store, screaming at everyone going in that broccoli are aliens hiding among us and are plotting to take over the planet. Michael and Kayla were married young, before his illness got bad, before the outbursts. Before the hospitalizations, before all the money started going toward his care. Before he kicked her so hard in the stomach, she miscarried their baby. He thought she'd been impregnated by the alien broccoli. He thought he was saving her. I cried when she told me that. I broke down and bawled because it was so fucking tragic. Then she told me about how he'd been following her since the separation. And those tears dried up real fucking quick. I wanted her to get a restraining order, but Kayla said that aside from the aforementioned kick, which, for obvious reasons, ended their marriage, Michael had only been violent with her once, many years ago. It was the day before their wedding. He lost his shit about some minor thing and grabbed her by the arm. He apologized, but it rattled her. Looking back, she said, that was the first sign that something in his brain was changing. The initial clue that everything would eventually go so terribly wrong. I wouldn't have blamed him. Had he been on top of his meds, I really wouldn't. Mental illness isn't something you do to yourself. It's not a choice. Your brain gets sabotaged by chemicals that are beyond your control. What is in your control, however, is your response to the sabotage. He was too proud to stay on his treatment plan. He thought he could handle his illness by himself. In his arrogance, he thought willpower alone was strong enough to conquer biology. He was wrong. Kayla paid the price for that arrogance. We both did. But like I told her in my letter, it's a price I'd gladly pay a million times over. Even if I had to do it every day until the end of eternity, I'd slice open my own veins with a razor blade and happily bleed myself dry. There was no way I was going to live without her. So dying for her was the only choice. My mistake was that I thought my blood alone would satisfy the monster inside her husband's head. Unfortunately, he was more bloodthirsty than I imagined.
39. Kayla. 4 months ago. As I sit at the kitchen table staring at my wedding ring in the palm of my hand, I sift through all the memories of my marriage to Michael, both good and bad.
until I realize that the reason I haven't taken off this ring before now is very simple. I've been honoring the dead, my dead child, my dead marriage, my dead hopes for the future that included them both. All the things I once cherished are gone. Now, the only way I can think of to move on from the past is to do what humans do when we mourn that which is no longer living. Hold a funeral. I go upstairs to the master bedroom and find an empty shoebox in the closet. In it, I put our marriage license, my wedding ring, and the black and white sonogram of the baby from my first ultrasound appointment, along with a few other mementos. Then I go out to the backyard with a spade I took from the shed and dig a hole beside the vine-covered pergola I told Michael I was pregnant under. When the hole is deep enough, I set the shoebox in. Then I cover it with dirt, every so often wiping the tears from my eyes with the back of one hand. My marriage has been over for a while now, but it still hurts. I know it always will. Pain is the cost of love, and the deeper your love goes, so too goes the pain. You can never have one without the other. I sit back on my heels, my throat choked with emotion. To the small mound of disturbed earth in front of me, I say, I loved you both with all my heart. I hope you can forgive me for all the ways I failed you. I think for a minute, but there's nothing more to say, so I make the sign of the cross over my chest and go back into the house to change. If my past is dead and buried, my future still awaits. It takes him a while to open the door after I knock. It's late, and he's not expecting me. I stand on the step with my heart pounding outside my chest and all my nerves on fire with longing until I hear his footsteps approach. The doorknob turns, then there he is. Though it's been a few weeks and our last meeting at the Harbor House restaurant didn't end well, Aiden looks at me as he always does. Like I'm the first sunrise he's ever seen in his entire life, my voice cracks when I say, "You told me to call you when I got clarity. I thought I'd knock instead." He glances down at my bare ring finger.
Thank fuck,
he says faintly, exhaling.
I haven't been able to breathe without you, bunny.
He grabs me in a bear hug and squeezes me so tight I can't breathe either. Then we're kissing. Hot, desperate kisses as he drags me through the door and inside his apartment. He kicks the door shut behind us and hugs me again, pressing his face against my neck. He holds me, his arms trembling, and I'm thankful for everything that brought me to this moment because I've never found anything finer than this. I whisper against his ear, thank you.
For what?
Giving me the space I needed, even though I didn't want it. But if you try giving me any more of it, I'll kick your ass. His laugh is low and breathless. He pulls away and gazes down at me with shining eyes.
How about if I give you something else you need?
I lift my brows and say coyly, depends on what it is. His grin turns wolfish, and his voice turns dark.
Oh, I think you know what it is, little rabbit.
He bends down, picks me up, and throws me over his shoulder, then carries me down the hallway to his bedroom, laughing as I feebly pummel my fists on his muscular butt. He kneels on the mattress and takes us down to the bed. I flinch and wince. Ow!
What's wrong?
There's something under my back. Aiden lifts himself up to allow me to roll to the side. From underneath me, he pulls out a book.
Sorry, I was reading.
He tosses the book aside and kisses me again, but I'm too curious to let this go that easily. What were you reading?
The Divine Comedy.
He tries to take my mouth, but can't as I'm still talking. What's the Divine Comedy? It sounds interesting. Pausing to glower down at me in disapproval, he says dryly,
we're having a book club meeting now.
I smile and toy with a lock of his dark hair. We have all the time in the world to do the other stuff, Mr. Lyon. Besides, I'm curious about your taste in literature.
Apparently, my taste in literature is as odd as my taste in women. We haven't seen each other in weeks. You're in my bed, and you're stalling me getting inside you. What's wrong with this picture?
I give him a peck on the lips, then reach over and pick up the book he tossed aside. It's a black hardback missing the dust jacket. The title and author name are embossed in gold on the spine. The Divine Comedy by Dante Alighieri. I say, that sounds like a made-up name. Aiden scoffs.
He's only the greatest poet ever.
Then how come I've never heard of him?
Maybe you're not as smart as you think.
I make a sour face. He grins. When I ask, "So what's this Divine Comedy about?" he sighs and rolls off me, settling on his back.
It's an epic poem about one man's journey through hell.
I laugh. Sounds like the perfect light reading before bed. He gazes at me with smiling eyes, though his face is attempting to look stern. He wants me to think he's disappointed that I'm not naked yet, but I know he's happy just to have me here. That makes two of us. I lift up onto an elbow and rest the book on his stomach. So tell me the story. How does it go? Why is it called a comedy if it's about hell? And why does the author's last name have so many I's in it? It's fake, right? Trying to stifle a laugh, he reaches up and tucks a lock of hair behind my ear.
I never realized how strange you are before now.
I lightly thump him on the chest with my knuckles. Like you're so normal. Tell me. With an exaggerated sigh, he pulls me down, sliding an arm under my neck and tucking me against his side. I snuggle there, closing my eyes and breathing in his warm scent of cedar, musk, and wood smoke. Happiness shimmers inside me, as light and airy as soap bubbles.
Dante was an Italian poet and scholar who was born in the 13th century.
No wonder I've never heard of him. Ignoring that, Aiden continues.
The story is about his soul's allegorical journey through the three realms of the dead, hell, purgatory, and heaven. He's accompanied by three spirit guides along the way who help him understand what's happening. At the end, he enters heaven, gains the knowledge of what God truly is, and achieves eternal salvation.
After a moment, I say, and you're reading it in bed on a Saturday night?
It's considered one of the world's greatest works of literature.
Please refer to my previous question. Chuckling, he kisses my forehead.
Not all of us had fancy university educations. I've made an ongoing effort to try to make up for lost time.
I open my eyes and look at him. He gazes back at me with a soft smile. I know he's talking about the time he spent in prison for what he did to his father. But we haven't really discussed that yet, so I'm hesitant to ask for details. Like, for example, how long he was there. Gently stroking my hair, he murmurs,
7 years.
Damn. The man can always read my mind. I whisper, was it awful? He nods. My throat closes, but I manage to say, I'm sorry.
It's in the past. This is what matters now.
He gives me a squeeze and a smile so tender it could break my heart in two. Holding back tears, I close my eyes and press my cheek against his chest. Sensing I'm on the verge of getting overly emotional, he has mercy on me and changes the subject.
What really blows my mind about Dante, other than his work, is that his name is an anagram for mine.
Anagram means what? Like it sounds similar? After a pause, he says,
you didn't really go to college, did you?
I thump him on the chest again. He chuckles and says,
an anagram is a word formed using all the letters of another word, like Iceman and cinema. You mix up all the letters and they spell something else.
I think about it for a moment. Okay, that's freaky.
What's freaky about it?
Your name and some famous 13th century Italian dude's names are the same.
They're not at all the same.
Yes, they are, if you mix up all the letters. He dissolves into laughter.
Oh, fuck, I've missed you.
Glad I amuse you, Fight Club. He takes the book off his stomach and sets it aside on the bed, then rolls on top of me, propping himself up on his forearms. Cradling my head in his hands and gazing down into my eyes, he murmurs,
but already my desire and my will were being turned like a wheel, all at one speed, by the love that moves the sun and the other stars.
When he doesn't add more and only lies there staring at me with intensity, I say, okay? He drops his forehead to my shoulder and laughs again, harder this time, his whole body shaking with it. I grumble. I fail to understand what's so hilarious here.
It's the last line of the final canto of the poem, where Dante ascends to heaven and is engulfed in the divine light and love of God. It's probably the most famous line of poetry in history.
No, the most famous line of poetry in history is, I do not like green eggs and ham. I do not like them, Sam, I am. That's Dr. Seuss, in case your reading hasn't progressed that far. He lifts his head and gazes at me, his eyes full of adoration and his grin blinding. Smiling back at him, I say, "So that's what heaven is, huh? Turning wheels and spinning stars?"
It was to Dante, anyway.
What do you think heaven is? His smile fades. His energy slowly changes from light to dark, as does his gaze. Looking deep into my eyes, he says softly,
"You."
That's the moment I finally let go of my past and my fears and fall, jump, rush, headlong in love with him. I wrap my arms around his neck and put it all into a kiss. Because he's Aiden, he gives it back to me 1,000-fold. From that night on, we're inseparable. We spend every waking and sleeping moment together. The next few months are what dreams are made of. Fairy tale come true. Then New Year's Eve arrives. And with it, the end. 40. Kayla. New Year's Eve. In the candlelight, Aiden's face is as beautiful as an angel's. "How are you so pretty?" I murmur, tracing a finger across the angle of his cheek, then down to his jaw. His dark beard is soft and springy under my fingertip. We're lying in bed at my house, facing each other, the lengths of our nude bodies aligned from chest to thighs. My feet are tucked between his calves. One of his biceps cradles my head. He's using the other arm to keep me bound tight against him. Gazing at me with soft eyes, he says,
"I'm not. You're just drunk with afterglow."
My laugh is low and throaty. Is that like beer goggles, but with sex?
Exactly. Your orgasm has made your vision fuzzy. In reality, I look like a warthog.
Smiling, I kiss the tip of his nose. "You do actually bear a striking resemblance to a warthog. I've been trying to spare your feelings by not bringing it up." Nuzzling my neck, he whispers,
"Speaking of bringing things up."
He flexes his hips, pressing his erection against my thigh. I laugh again, feeling high and reckless, as if I'm standing at the top of a tall cliff about to tumble over the edge. "Have you never heard of the refractory period?"
"I have, but my dick hasn't."
Clearly. He quirks a brow.
"Are you complaining?"
That makes me grin. "No, sir, I love it." He rolls over on top of me. Lowering his head, he kisses me softly, murmuring against my lips.
"Say that again, bunny."
"The sir part or the love part?"
"Both."
His eyes darken and his voice drops.
"But leave out the no and the it."
I have to think about that for a moment. When I understand what he wants me to say, my cheeks heat. But I give him what he wants, without reservation and without regret, the way he needs it. Gazing into his eyes, my face hot and my heart pounding, I whisper, "I love you, sir." He moistens his lips. His breathing goes erratic. Heavy and warm on top of me, he feels like the anchor that will keep me steady and the harbor that will keep me safe no matter how strong the storm. Rubbing his thumb slowly back and forth over the slope of my cheek, he says in a husky voice,
"And I love my sweet little rabbit, who made me grateful for every day I walked through hell, because that dark path eventually led to her."
I breathe out a soft sob, but he silences it as he kisses me. I think he's going to push inside me, but he rolls to his back instead, taking me along so I'm lying atop him. Holding my hair back from my face, he says casually,
"There's supposed to be fireworks at midnight tonight."
Wow.
What?
Talk about a disappointing segue. I thought you were about to make love to me again. He chuckles.
I was. Then I got the genius idea of taking the boat out so there would be fireworks exploding overhead the next time I make you come.
Ah, yes, that would be a memorable way to ring in the new year. We grin at each other. He says,
"How about chocolate and champagne? Just in case you were up for it."
In what universe would I not be up for you feeding me champagne and chocolate under a fireworks-filled sky after giving me a mind-blowing orgasm?
Oh, so I'm feeding you now, too.
He rolls his eyes in mock dismay.
I have to do all the work around here.
I press a kiss to his lips and whisper, "Poor baby." He tosses me onto my back and growls.
Careful. Warthogs eat bunnies for dinner.
Then he nips at my neck and tickles me, making me scream. Laughing, he rises. I watch, smiling, as he goes into the closet. He emerges, clothed, soon thereafter.
Get that sweet behind moving,
he says, shooting me a wicked grin as he leaves the room.
I'll meet you downstairs.
I pop up from bed and dress as quickly as I can, pulling on jeans and a thick sweater over a long-sleeved shirt. It's not raining tonight, but with the temperature in the low 50s, it will be cold on the water. I shove my feet into a pair of boots and head downstairs, grinning. It's strange how light joy makes your body feel. If I concentrated, I bet I could float right off the ground. I find Aiden in the kitchen loading the champagne, chocolates, and a pair of champagne glasses into a picnic basket. I tease. Look at you, so domestic.
I think the word you're looking for is romantic.
I go up behind him and wrap my arms around his waist. Resting my cheek against his broad back, I murmur,
actually, the word I'm looking for is amazing. No, wonderful. No, that's not it either.
Glorious,
he supplies, turning to embrace me.
I'll take spectacular, too.
Yeah, I bet you would.
He kisses me, cradling my face in his hands. It's a sweet kiss, but it quickly turns heated. I pull out of his arms, laughing.
Okay, Fight Club. Let's get this show on the road or we'll never make it out of the kitchen.
So bossy,
he says, shaking his head. He's trying to frown, but not quite managing it. I'll get a couple blankets, meet you at the back door. I leave him in the kitchen and go hunting through the linen closet in the guest bedroom for the throws kept folded in a stack. Choosing two that are thick and soft, I wrap one around my shoulders and carry the other to where Aiden stands waiting at the door with the wicker basket in hand. When I drape the blanket across his shoulders, he makes a face.
You realize warthogs don't get cold, right? We're way too tough for that.
I wave him aside. Be quiet, macho man. He'll thank me when we're on the water.
We head across the lawn and down to the rocky beach toward the Eurydice tied at the end of the dock. The air is fresh and cold. It smells strongly of pine sap, wet bark, and moss. Above us, the sky is a bowl of deep sapphire sprinkled with stars. It's still and quiet except for the crickets serenading us with their evening song. Aiden grasps my hand and squeezes it, glancing down to smile at me.
If there is a heaven, I hope it's exactly like this.
Aiden helps me onto the stern of the boat, then hands me the picnic basket. He hops over the edge of the hull and unties the ropes from the cleats on the side while I climb the narrow stairs up to the bridge. Elevated above the main and lower decks, it offers an unrestricted view of the water. Moonlight shines off the dark, undulating waves. The sound is calm tonight, and the skies are clear, which will make for spectacular fireworks viewing. I run the blower for a minute to clear fumes from the engine compartment, then turn the batteries on and fire up the engines. After checking the gauges to make sure we're good to go, I call down to Aiden. You ready? He doesn't answer. Walking over to the stairs, I call more loudly. Aiden? Still no response. He must not be able to hear me over the engines. Because the stairs are so steep, going down the steps is slightly more awkward than going up. I have to climb down carefully, facing inward and grasping the metal railings on either side. When my feet finally touch the deck, I turn around, expecting to see Aiden in the seating area on the stern. He's not there. The picnic basket sits alone on the table. Frowning, I glance inside the main cabin and freeze in horror. Aiden stands stiffly on one side of the cabin, staring at the man standing across from him about 6 feet away. It's Michael, wearing the same gray trench coat and hat I've seen him in several times over the past few months, when I've caught glimpses of him following me. He's thin and unkempt, with hollowed cheeks and dark shadows under his wild eyes. His arms hang by his sides. In one trembling hand, he grips a silver pistol. I suck in a breath. My heartbeat slams into overdrive. A cold tremor runs through me, chilling me all the way down to my bones. My voice high with stress, I say, Michael, what are you doing? Eyes rolling, he replies in a hushed whisper.
He's with the government, Kayla. He's with the CIA. He wants information from me. He wants my equations.
Terrified, I swallow and look at Aiden. He stands perfectly still, every muscle in his body tensed. My mind is a rabid animal, scratching sharp claws at the inside of my skull. Where did he get a gun? Does he know how to shoot it? Is it even loaded? He looks homeless. Where has he been living? Oh, God. Has he been sleeping on the boat? Though I'm panicked and desperate, I try to keep my voice as calm and soothing as I can. No, Michael. He's not with the CIA. Spittle flies from his lips when he screams.
He's with the CIA! He's trying to steal my equations!
He jerks his arm up and points the gun at Aiden's chest. I'm so frightened, I think I might faint. Aiden remains perfectly still, his face impassive and his breathing shallow. I see wheels turning behind his eyes and am terrified of what might happen next. Swallowing a sob, I lift my hands and start pleading.
No, please listen to me. He's not with the government. I promise you he's not. He's in construction, okay? He's my friend.
Michael licks his cracked lips. He shifts his weight restlessly from foot to foot. That hand holding the pistol is now shaking hard. Then he slices his wild gaze in my direction.
He's your friend?
I grasp my mistake when Michael turns the gun toward me. I jerk back a step, a scream caught in my throat. Aiden says firmly,
No, we're not friends. She just said you were. I've been lying to her.
Michael looks back and forth between us, then jerks the gun back in Aiden's direction.
Lying? So I could get close to her. So I could get your equations.
Aiden looks at me. What I see in his eyes makes me want to scream. It's so stupid. So stupid and reckless and so fucking like him, the self-sacrificing fool. No, God, no, this isn't happening. This can't be happening. He looks back at Michael and says calmly,
Let her go. You and I can talk better if she's not here.
No, Aiden, I won't.
Be quiet, Kayla.
I'm not getting off this boat.
You are. Right now. Do it.
Michael's wild gaze darts back and forth between us. In his eyes, I see nothing of the man I was married to. The psychosis has swallowed him whole. My pulse is a roar of thunder in my ears. How can I distract him? What can I hit him with? The fire extinguisher. It's right over there. Seeing me looking around in panic, Michael suddenly screams.
You're with the CIA too. She's just scared,
says Aiden.
You're pointing a gun at her. Anyone would be scared.
Panting, Michael hisses.
You're not scared. That's because of my CIA training. Kayla, get the fuck off this boat.
God damn it, Aiden, no. No, stop this. Tears stream down my face. My vision is blurred by them. My breathing is labored. I take a halting step backward, then another, hysteria gripping me in a cold, crushing hand. I can call 911. If I can make it to the house and Aiden could keep Michael talking, I can call the police and get them here before anything awful happens. I stop short when Michael says in the barest of whispers,
No, she's in the CIA too. I see it on your face.
He looks at me. His voice rises.
You both have to die.
When I sob and clap my hands over my mouth, Aiden says in a commanding voice,
Nobody has to die. Just put the gun down and we can talk about it.
Rocking back and forth from foot to foot, his hand shaking and all the whites of his eyes showing, Michael screams.
What if you have to die? You have to choose right now who dies, who dies, who dies. If you don't choose, I have to kill you both.
He points the gun at me again. He points it right at my face. The only reason I don't topple over is because terror has turned my muscles to stone. Aiden says,
If we choose, you'll only shoot one of us?
My heart stops beating then. It stops, dead in my chest, stalled by horror. No, Aiden, stop it. Don't say another word.
Michael?
Aiden, no. Stop it! Michael screams.
Yes!
And cocks the hammer of the pistol with his thumb. Aiden looks at me. His heart shines in his eyes. He says softly,
I love you, Bunny. I'll love you until the end of time.
Then he looks back at Michael and says words I'll never be able to unhear. They'll echo in my head for all eternity.
Shoot me then.
Time changes. Everything takes on the surreal quality of a dream. I see what happens next. unfold in front of me like a movie played in slow motion with the sound warped and the colors blurred, dragging by at half speed. Michael swings his arm toward Aiden. Aiden lunges. A fireball explodes from the end of Michael's gun. Aiden's head snaps back. The forward motion of his body stops abruptly, as if he's been slammed against a wall. A small red hole appears in the center of his forehead. Blood and chunks of brain matter splatter the window behind him. He falls back, his eyes open, and his mouth slack. Collapsing onto the sofa, he lies still and silent, gazing sightlessly at the ceiling as a dark stain creeps across the beige cushion under his head. In the night sky above us, fireworks burst into sprays of color with a crackle and boom. My scream is a living thing, a creature of horror, disbelief, and heartbreak clawing its way up my throat. I fly across the space between us with that scream surrounding me everywhere, vibrating in my ears and in my head, inside all the hidden sacred places in my soul that only he has ever touched. I fall on top of Aiden's lifeless body, screaming and screaming the same thing over and over, the thing every cell in my body screams along with me. No, 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 no. He doesn't look at me. He doesn't respond to any of my desperate pleas or the kisses I rain over his cheeks and lips. He can't. He's gone. Sobbing hysterically, I cling to him until something hard and heavy bashes me in the back of the head. Pain shoots through my skull. I see stars. For a moment, my vision goes black. When light fills my eyes again, I'm on my back, and Michael is dragging me by my wrists across the wood deck toward the swim step at the back of the boat. My words come out slurred. Michael, what are you doing? I can't make out what he mumbles to himself. It's incoherent, babbling, nonsensical words spoken between labored breaths as he drags me away from Aiden's body. I try to pull my wrists from his grip, but don't have the strength. Hot liquid trickles down my neck. Blood. He must have hit me with something heavy. The gun. He pistol-whipped me with the gun. More fireworks explode overhead. I see them above us. Starbursts of color painting the midnight sky like the domed roof of a cathedral. Smoke drifts over the water. Somewhere far away, a dog barks. Michael drags me to the edge of the stern and rolls me off. The water is cold, black shock, cutting through my stupor like a blade. I go under for a moment before starting to kick and flail. I break the surface, sputtering and gasping, disoriented and panicking, fear as sharp as a knife shoved between my ribs. I cough and scream. The boat's engines hum and rumble. Michael looms over me on the step, laughing maniacally now, his lips peeled back from his teeth. I flail at the step, missing it by inches. Michael drops to his knees and reaches out. I grasp his hand, thinking he's offering help, but quickly discover he's not. He grabs me by the throat and squeezes. He pushes me down and holds me under. Even underwater, I can hear his crazy laugh. Something slips out of his shirt pocket. It splashes into the water and tumbles past my face, small and round, silver and glinting. It's his lucky 1937 Buffalo nickel, the one he never left home without. I kick and struggle. My heart hammers against my ribcage. Salt water stings my eyes and burns my lungs. Fireworks illuminate the surface of the water in a shimmering kaleidoscope of colors. I can't get his fingers off my neck. I claw at his hands, thrashing and coughing, smelling diesel fuel and gunpowder, smoke and sea and blood. Aiden. Aiden, I love you. I love you. My body is heavy. The churning water above me stills. I drift, my hair floating around my head, my eyes turned toward the surface, my hand outstretched for help that doesn't come. A brilliant bloom of color suffuses the sea above me in shades of red, green, and gold. Then the fireworks fade, and everything goes black. My heart throbs one final time before stopping for good.
3. Paradiso. Death is not extinguishing the light. It is only putting out the lamp because the dawn has come. Rabindranath Tagore. 41. Kayla.
What we call memory is the intersection between imagination and fact. Memories are the stories we tell ourselves about the important events in our lives. In the telling, some details get lost, others embellished until truth is closer to fiction. It's like Fiona said, each of us make our own truths, even ghosts. I suppose I should have figured it out the day she came in the house and disarmed the security alarm without me having told her the code. That was the same day she said she thought something was troubling me and that ghosts need closure. By that time, she'd been working for the Wainwrights for more than a month. They kept her on when they bought the house, never knowing just how helpful she'd turn out to be. She isn't quite as gifted as her sister Claire, but the gift does run in the family. It took months of me sifting through memories and reliving my past to understand what happened. I lived two parallel lives, one past and one present, removed from reality but believing myself in it, utterly blind to the truth. Everything that happened with Aiden was real. So was everything that happened after New Year's, but it got all jumbled together and mixed up because being dead and not realizing it is very fucking confusing. Past, present, fact, memory, everything interconnected and part of a whole. Like individual pages in a book before it's bound. But now my binding is set. My story is told. The book of my life has been written to its final chapter. All that's left is to close the cover and put it away. When I open my eyes, nothing looks the same. The walls are painted a different color. The carpet has been replaced by wood. The furnishings are unfamiliar, as are the people and the framed photographs on the walls. The house is very different from when I lived in it. Different, but familiar. Like the face of a friend you haven't seen in many years. I never noticed the changes before. But the blinds have been lifted from my eyes now. My vision is finally clear. The storm outside has ceased raging. Everything is still. Beyond the living room windows, dawn spreads glimmering light over the yard and faraway hills. I hear birds chirping, smell springtime in the air, and marvel at the beauty of it all. The doorbell rings. I move toward the front door, compelled by a force as elemental as gravity, as unstoppable as time. I turn the knob, pull the door open, and find Aiden standing on the porch. He's drenched in golden sunlight, smiling at me as if I'm the first sunrise he's ever seen.
"Hey, bunny,"
he says softly, his eyes shining with adoration.
"Did you miss me?"
I fall into his arms. His embrace is sweeter than 1,000 kisses, better than 1,000,000 wishes, more perfect than any dream could ever be. "You found me," I whisper, crying tears of joy. He rubs his cheek against mine, breathing me in as he holds me tight.
"I never lost you. Who do you think has been ringing the doorbell this whole time?"
I bury my face in his neck. "I'm sorry. I didn't know. I couldn't see. I was so confused." He murmurs against my ear.
"It's okay. I told you I'd wait forever if I had to."
When I raise my head and stare at him through watering eyes, he smiles a smile of such beauty it takes my breath away. I say, "The life jacket was a nice touch."
"I thought so."
"Was that you during the seance, or was I doing all the knocking and special effects?"
"That was me. But all the other stuff that went on in the house was you. The flickering lights, the open cupboards, the TV going on and off. I'm sorry to say you made it pretty miserable for the Wainwrights."
"Well, I'm dead and melodramatic. You'd think making it to the afterlife would give a person a certain perspective on things," he says gently.
"You were traumatized. Give yourself a break."
"And my wedding ring falling through the ceiling? The coin that kept getting moved? I suppose that was you too?"
"None of that matters now. What matters is that we're together."
"But wait, how come I didn't understand what was happening, but you did?" He smiles.
"Maybe I'm just smarter than you are."
That isn't even a little bit funny.
all around us, the golden light grows brighter. I feel a pleasant urgency, an upward pull that increases with each incremental lift of light. I want to surrender to the pull, but I have something I need to ask first. Why did you postmark all the letters from prison? Was that a clue about your past? He smiles.
More like a clue about the future.
What do you mean?
Washington State Penitentiary is where a certain asshole is being held on charges of murder. I've been thinking we should pay him a visit.
I recall how Fiona told me that schizophrenics can see ghosts and can't help but laugh. Oh, Aiden, you're diabolical. The golden light surrounding us grows brighter. Then he takes my face in his hands and kisses me. In his lips I taste forever. That and something almost as sweet. Revenge.
Epilogue. Transcribed from the notes and session recording of March 16, conducted by Dr. Patrick Templeman, forensic psychiatrist with Michael Reese, currently awaiting trial on charges of first-degree murder. Dr. Templeman, thank you for joining me today, Mr. Reese. Michael Reese. It's Dr. Reese, and you say that as if I had a choice in the matter. They brought me down here in handcuffs. Have you noticed the handcuffs? Dr. Templeman. How are you feeling today? Michael Reese. I wonder how many times you'll say the word today before you get to the point. Dr. Templeman. As you are aware, Mr. Reese, my objective is to determine your current mental capacity to stand trial, as ordered by the court. Michael Reese. The court can kiss my ass, and so can you. And it's Dr. Reese. Dr. Templeman. Do you understand the charges brought against you? Michael Reese. Let me tell you something. You're not the only person in this room with a big degree. I've got three of them, all right? PhD, masters, etc., all from Ivy League schools. Your medical degree doesn't impress me. Physician's note. Patient is visibly agitated. Pronounced tremor of left hand is evident. Possible side effect of antipsychotic medication. Dr. Templeman. You have been administered a daily dose of oral flufenazine to alleviate your symptoms since your arrest. Is that correct? Michael Reese. Are you the best they could do? You look about as competent as that public defender they assigned me. Dr. Templeman. How is your relationship with the attorney? Do you feel he's adequately described the charges brought against you? Michael Reese. That idiot couldn't adequately describe the color of a turd. They'd let anyone pass the bar these days, apparently. Dr. Templeman. Can you tell me what the charges against you are, please? Michael Reese. Seriously? Dr. Templeman. I'm trying to evaluate if you understand what's happening to you. Michael Reese. Yes, I understand what's happening to me. I'm being held for something I did while in the grip of a psychotic break. Dr. Templeman. We're speaking of the murder of your estranged wife, Kayla, and Aiden Leewright. Is that correct? Michael Reese. Jesus Christ, this is going to take forever. Dr. Templeman. Do you recall the events of December 31st last year? Michael Reese. I'm not an imbecile. Dr. Templeman. I'll take that as a yes. Will you please describe for me what you feel your current relationship with your attorney is like? Michael Reese, unintelligible. Dr. Templeman, what do you think will happen if you are convicted on the charges? Michael Reese, I won't be convicted. Someone like me shouldn't be in prison. Dr. Templeman, someone like you? Michael Reese, I'm a highly respected member of the community. My work is incredibly important. I'm not some rapist or drug dealer. Those people should be behind bars, not me. Dr. Templeman. You don't believe a double homicide is just cause for a prison sentence? Michael Reese. I can't be held responsible for that. Dr. Templeman. Do you regret what happened? Michael Reese. I regret that you're wasting my time with this ridiculous line of questioning. Physician's note. Patient displays traits of narcissistic personality disorder. Dr. Templeman. What do you understand regarding the stages of the proceedings in a capital murder case? Has that been adequately explained to you? Michael Reese. I understand that if I'm determined to be incompetent, I won't have to stand trial, which I shouldn't because of who I am. Geniuses shouldn't be on trial, or in jail for that matter. I have an IQ of over 200 points, for Christ's sake. Dr. Templeman. Do you also understand that if you are found fit for trial, the fact that you committed murder while experiencing a psychotic episode will not reduce your sentence? Michael Reese. What? No, that's not true. I wasn't in my right mind. What are you talking about? Dr. Templeman. The issue is intent. You have a documented history of refusing to take antipsychotic medication, even after being counseled that it could result in outbursts of violence. The prosecutor will introduce evidence that you were well aware of the possibility you could harm your wife. He will also introduce evidence that you were involved in a long-term affair with a co-worker at the university. Sharon, I believe, is her name? Or is it Karen? I'm sorry, I don't have those notes in front of me. There's also the matter of the life insurance policy you took out on your wife. Was she aware of that policy? Michael Reese. Listen, I've had enough of this. I want... Dr. Templeman. Yes, go on. Physician's note. Patient is fixating on a spot on the wall and becoming unresponsive. He appears to be in extreme distress. Dr. Templeman. Mr. Reese, are you unwell? Michael Reese. Oh, God. Oh, my God. Dr. Templeman. Mr. Reese. Physician's note. Patient is screaming. Attempts to exit the interview room. Pounds on the door in visible panic. Dr. Templeman. Mr. Reese, what's wrong? Tell me what's happening. Michael Reese. It's her. It's her and him both. Oh, God. Let me out of here. Let me out of this fucking room. Physician's note. Patient appears to be experiencing psychosis-related visual disturbance. Dr. Templeman. Mr. Reese, we're alone in the room. Michael Reese. She's right fucking there, you fucking idiot! Look! Look! Dr. Templeman. You're suffering a hallucination. You and I are the only people in this room. Physician's note. Patient has crouched in the corner of the room and resumed screaming. Dr. Templeman. Mr. Reese, will you please calm down? I'll have to call for you to be tranquilized if you can't control yourself. Michael Reese. Stop saying that! Stop saying that! Stop saying that word! Dr. Templeman. What word are you hearing, Michael? Is someone speaking to you? What are they saying? Michael Reese. Boo! Physician's note. After being restrained by guards, patient received intramuscular injection of phenobarbital and was transferred to the psychiatric department for further evaluation. Hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Pen Pal, written by J.T. Geisinger, narrated by Tara Langella and Troy Duran. This program was produced by Audio Sorceress, text copyright 2022 by J.T. Geisinger. Performance and production copyright 2022 by J.T. Geisinger. All rights reserved. For more information on our productions, please visit our website at www.audiosorceress.com. Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.